Good evening. Many of us learned quite a few different things from these meetings. And tonight, we're going to be listening to Gary Guthrie, who had his experience in South Africa during the midst of the apartheid policy that they had, and demonstrated a great deal of courage by coming out and stating some things relative to his newfound abilities after he had a near-death experience. He could see auras. And he noticed that the auras of blacks and those of whites were identical. And many people assume that an aura represents something regarding your spiritual advancement. And so he assumed from that, apparently, that blacks and whites were equal spiritually. That got him fired. Courageous people have changed this world. And so I am looking forward to hearing from one of those people tonight in the form of Gary Guthrie. And let's welcome him.
Well, I'm very happy to be here in Utah. I spent the decade of the 1960s at BYU. I graduated from BYU in 1969. When I was at BYU, most of Orem was orchards. So it's interesting to come back now and to see all the changes, and all the changes that are occurring here in Salt Lake City. When I left BYU, I worked for 10 years in different parts of the world. I worked for a while in Singapore, in the Philippines, and ended up in South Africa teaching. And when I had my near-death experience, the love that I felt from a light was so wonderfully intense that I wanted to retain some of it as the years went by. So I became a prolific reader of any near-death experience literature I could get my hands on. And I was able to talk to a lot of people who had had near-death experiences, like Beverly Brodsky. She's the director of the IONS group in San Diego. Melvin Morris, who is a pediatrician who works with children who have had near-death experiences, and collected different quotations from them, and especially what they heard when they were in the light, what the light told them. The reason that these quotations are so important is that it's a direct source. It's not a secondary source like you get when you have some of the world's religions, that their scriptures come from where a group of men will come together to vote on what scriptures will fit into their canon. This is how the Buddhist scriptures were formed, and how the Bible is formed. But these are not secondary sources, they're directly from the light. And so, in that way, they're very significant. The title of this book, Opening to the Light, well, of course, the light refers to this magnificent power that's behind the universe, and that's within all of our lives. The light is extremely loving and compassionate, and once you've experienced it, gradually your life begins to change over the years. There'll be times when you find yourself thinking about that time in the light and how beautiful it was. I use a lotus on here because this is a symbol of a Tibetan Buddhist mantra, which is Om Mani Padme Hum. When the Tibetan Buddhists say this mantra, the Dalai Lama breaks it down into six powers. Om is one power, Ma, Ni, He, Me, Hum. And this can be, the six powers can be anything that you feel that helps you in your life, that you feel it's important, a divine quality that you feel that if you had, or if you could develop further, it would help you in your spiritual progress. Such things as faith and joy. Six powers that the Dalai Lama says encompass everything that the Buddha taught. So Om Mani Padme Hum, they repeat this constantly. And what I see that they're repeating, or what they're thinking about, is they're thinking about this lotus blossom. The lotus blossom is like, it grows in muddy, murky waters that are sometimes filthy. And they're thinking, could I be like this lotus blossom, that although it comes from an environment that's sometimes polluted and dark, may I rise up out of these waters and open up to the light? And may I see this light in other people? May I see this light in myself and in the teachings of the world around me? It says that these are messages from near-death experiences. Well, this phrase, near-death experience, was coined by Dr. Raymond Moody in 1976. And he was not very pleased with this phrasing, near-death experience, because of the word death. Why did he feel this way? Because most people, when they hear the word death, they think of something that's totally final. That when you pass away, there's a you go into oblivion. A lot of people say, when you're dead, period. That's not what people that have had near-death experiences have said. This book quotes Walt Whitman. He's a famous American poet who claimed to have had a near-death experience. And he said, "Do you not see, O my brothers and my sisters, it is not chaos, it is not a finality, it is plan, it is union, it is bliss, it is happiness." This airplane crash that occurred the day before yesterday in Alaska, where Ted Stevens passed away, there was someone very similar to him from World War I, Edward Rickenbacker. He was a World War I flying ace, highly decorated. After his service, he was hired by Eastern Airlines. He was flying a plane, and it crashed. And the rescuers who came, they checked his vital signs and everything, and they said, "He's dead. It's just worked on the ones that are still alive." And they took him into a morgue, but he revived. It's very similar to, like, Lazarus. He said, "Death is the sweetest, tenderest, most sensual experience I have ever experienced in life. It is not a frightful thing. It is a sympathetic friend." Dr. Melvin Morris, who's a pediatrician among children come to him after their experiences, and they say things like, "Wow, that was really a great experience. It was nothing like what the media says." You know, the media, they present it as something very scary, like Poltergeist and Halloween 1, 2, 3, 4. They said it was nothing at all like that. It was heaven is a really fun place. He says, "You've got to get out there and you've got to tell everybody, especially the older people. Tell them not to be afraid." And it's like a song that Leonard Cohen wrote. He said, "Ring the bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offerings. There is a light in everything. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets through." So the light is something that we can open to. One person who might have had a near-death experience, who writes a lot about spiritual things, was the English poet Robert Browning. And he says the truth or salvation consists in opening out a way the imprisoned splendor may come forth. The imprisoned splendor is light. Not seeking from without, but seeking from within. And so that has been the importance of meditation among spiritual seekers down through the ages and among near-death experiencers. They feel that sometimes when they go into meditation, that they sense the love and the bliss that they had in their near-death experience. They allow their breath to be their guide, to bring them deeper into a centering into themselves, a centering into the light. Eckhart Tolle says is that when you do that, that sometimes the light can, you're meditated by the light, and you're meditated by and with the light. So that's why I spent 10 years gathering these quotations from near-death experiencers. putting them together. And each chapter has a picture in it from nature. We chose my publisher suggested choosing nature because if you use religious symbols, that turns a lot of people off. You know, if I wanted to put some Hindu pictures in here of Krishna and the milkmaids bathing in the light, for example, and they think, oh, that'll really turn a lot of people off. So they said, nature doesn't turn anybody off. We've got pictures from the Hubble telescope, different galaxies out in outer space, and these are very beautiful photographs. Buddha once said that if you really saw, or if you really comprehended what a flower was, it could change your whole life. So he once gave a sermon where he got up and he just held up a flower, and he didn't say a word, and that was his total sermon. Thich Nhat Hanh says that when you look at a flower and when you really begin to comprehend it, you realize that a flower can include everything. It can include the sky, the rainbows, the earth, the seeds, the sunshine, living and dying and rebirth. When we turn to some of these chapters in here, I'll give you a preview of a couple of chapters. For example, chapter 27 is called Our Greatest Joy. And it says, the ancient Egyptians believed that when they would pass away, they would have a life review. And they would be asked two questions during their life review. The first question was, did you receive joy while you were alive? And then the second question was did you give joy? And that was a very important thing to them. And I remember from being at BYU, the quotation that I came with, that I came away with, that I remember hearing more often than any other quotation, was that happiness is the object and design of our existence, and will be the end thereof if we pursue a path that leads to it. When this book quotes a Matthew Ricard, who is a Tibetan Buddhist philosopher and writer from France, but who lives in, that acts as a translator for Tibetans. He said that happiness is a learned skill. And what it is, it's a lot like your physical body. If you will purge your physical body of harmful elements, you know, if you can eat healthy foods and rid your body of toxins, that you will feel a lot better. You have a healthy body that way. And he said the same thing with your psyche or with your spirit or with your soul, that if you will purge yourself of things like anger, hatred, animosity, and resentment, then you will feel a lot better. Katie Byron, she's a person who had some similar experience, like a near-death experience, where she found herself at rock bottom, lying in her own. She received an inspiration, which she said, a lot of our problems is a mental dialogue that we've got going on in our heads. Sometimes it goes on with consciously aware that it's going on. And it consists of things like, well, yeah, they said that to me, and that just really gets me. And then, well, she said, and then he said, and, you know, if I want to get back at them, what can I say? She says, this dialogue goes, as it's going on, you should stop yourself in this dialogue and ask yourself, is this really true? Even if it is it that important, especially what it's doing to me? And to, you know, catch yourself in the situation. Other near-death experiencers, such as Keith Keller, he says, my near-death experience taught me that if you don't know how to love, you won't experience the joy of living. And so this quotation that I learned at BYU, you know, happiness is the object and design of our existence, if you flip that to what the near-death experiencers would say, they would say, loving compassion is the object and design of our existence. Because 90% of these quotations in the book that people receive from the light center around, have you learned to love? That's what the light asks people. you live to 11? How are you progressing in that? And then when they're shown a life review, it's usually their relationships with other people. They're not being judged. They're just being shown what's going on in their life. And they more or less judge themselves as to how they want to proceed. This is not necessarily religious or spiritual. It is essential for world peace as people learn to interact with each other to a greater degree, we'll have greater world peace. If you want to have a good environment to live in, good air to breathe, you should have concern for the planet and things like that, and loving compassion towards the wildlife and the nature on the planet. The Sanskrit word for happiness means sukha, and sukha is the opposite of the word dukkha, is the word for suffering. In Buddhism, that's the suffering that Buddha kept talking a lot about. But then the flip side of that is sukha. And sukha is a peace, an inner peace, that's so deep. It's like you're on an ocean of water. And if there's storms on the outside, or in your environment, in your life, heavy storms, yet deep down inside, there is peace and tranquility, and that is sukha. And that, according to the early Hindu religion, was happiness. This is why they emphasized meditation, is that India is such a chaotic place. I don't know how many of you have been there, but I've been there about 4 or 5 times, and each time when I leave, I say, I'm never going to go back there again. But then, after a while, you forget the chaotic, and you think about some of the good things you saw there, you know, the temples and the nature. And so you go back to see something else. Yeah, sukha is this inner state that comes through meditation. And this is why so many Hindus practice yoga and meditation, is because they're able to live in that environment by practicing meditation. This book also quotes a modern physicist by the name of David Bohm. He says that in his research, he finds that we are enclosed in another reality, that we're living in another reality, like a higher reality that we don't see around us. And Betty Eady, who is an LDS writer, or who is raised partly LDS. She was an American Indian on reservations. But I asked her one time after reading her book, Embraced by the Light, I said, you're LDS, I'm sure. And she admitted that she was. Because in her book, she says that the other reality that we're enfolded in is like being embraced by the light. And when you read her book, it talks about our pre-existence and coming down to the earth and living here and going back to another realm. And another thing that's significant in this book is it talks about having a conscious death. A conscious death is when you prepare for it. This is what they do in Tibet. They prepare for their own death by every day using this mantra over and over again, Om Mani Padme Hum. Means the jewel is in the lotus, but it has a deeper significance of following what you believe is your highest, those things that will lead you to your higher good, your six powers. For non-Tibetans, this can mean, I know that in the Unity Church, they talk about 12 powers, and we have 12 powers like faith, zeal, and illumination, and you know, eliminating things that don't serve us in our lives, gathering other powers that do serve us. In the LDS Articles of Faith, the 13th Article of Faith is that they talk about honesty, truth, benevolence, and doing good to all people. So these are like powers that if you follow those powers, they will when you come to the point of death, then you anticipate it. The Tibetan Tibetan Book of the Dead, it's like these Tibetan monks, they come to a person who is about ready to die, they're the Tibetan hospice. They quote from the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it says, O nobly born, that means you and I, you of glorious origins, remember your radiant true nature, trust it, return to it, it is home. T.S. Eliot said that the aim of all of our existence will be to eventually arrive where we originally began and to know the place for the first time. Those of you that have been to Astoria, a city on the Columbia River when it reaches the Pacific Ocean in Oregon or in Washington State, if you're coming down the river in a boat, you'll notice that the waters from the ocean will come up to meet you. This is what Tibetans say it is like to die, that as you're approaching death, the light from the other side is coming, or the ocean of, they call it the ocean of divinity, or the ocean of light, that it's coming to greet you, and your light is like a river proceeding to this ocean of infinity. And so when the waters meet or when the lights meet, your inner light and this the light of the divine, that is a very blissful thing. Many spiritual people die with a beautiful smile on their face because they're being embraced by this light. You can also find it in symbols like flowers. You can find a certain beauty. Eckhart Tolle says, a flower, how still it is, how deeply rooted in the light or beingness. Allow nature to teach you of patience and of stillness. This reminds me of a quote that Jesus once gave in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, if you look at a flower, it is clothed by our Heavenly Father more beautifully than Solomon was ever clothed. If God can clothe a flower to be that beautiful, how much more can He clothe you and I? So it's telling us to trust the process of life. A lot of times there's a lot of fear about get older and lose our faculties and start being forgetful that we somehow, what's going on? Yes, these quotations help you with the process. Trust the process and to realize that it's all okay. Many near-death experiencers said that all things will eventually work themselves out fine. That what we're going through right now, there's a lot of stones along the path, more or less, but they say it'll eventually, you'll understand everything, that the things that we're going through that somehow seems like, whoa, where did this came out of left field? How did this get in my karma or in my life? They say it will all work out beautifully. The last chapter says that if you do not feel that you are enlightened, which means enlightened means having a greater awareness of the light that's with you all the time. If you do not have this, act as if you were aware. This is something that Shakespeare also taught. And what one famous Jewish rabbi, Aaron of Carlin, said, he says, act as if the radiant light of God were fully conscious in your life right now. Buckminster Fuller is quoted in this chapter by saying that, for God to me it seems is a verb and not a noun. And I think what he meant by a verb is that God is responsive. He responds to our needs and our lives, even when we feel that there's total silence and it's like we're not getting anywhere. The heavens are as steel to me. And so God is also interactive. It's an interactive process. The prophet Rumi, who was the founder of Sufi dancing, he had an experience where he lost the love of his life. He had a guru or a teacher who was very enlightened and was teaching him, and his friends or his disciples were jealous. So they did away with this friend of his, Shams. Shams means the sun. He called him the son of my life. He was so emotionally upset about the loss of a loved one, his life, that he began dancing around the pillar. As he danced around, he became centered, and he could feel the presence of the light, him, the light that the Shams had introduced him to. Well, Rumi is quoted in this book, and Rumi says, keep knocking, you know, like knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Just keep knocking. And eventually, the joy inside will open up a door to look out to see who's there. Rumi also said, when you die, you are embraced by love, so what is there to fear? What I find that working with these quotations is that, and talking to other near-death experiencers, when they start talking about like changes that are going to occur in the world, the topic of 2012 comes up. And people feel in the near-death experience community is that it's not going to happen overnight. It probably won't even happen in 2012. But it will be like Joe Garacci said. He was a New York policeman who had a near-death experience. And he says, as I tell my experience about the loving light, it reaches out to other people. And as more near-death experiencers tell their experience, it will grow. And love is more powerful than hatred. And eventually the equation will change like a hundredth monkey. People get on board, so to speak, then there will be a change in the consciousness of humanity. Greg Braden feels that it's going to happen much later than 2012, but it started. It started around 2005 or something, and that there is a gradual shift. And if you have this feeling that perhaps there's a shift going on, it is exciting, as it was for the people back in 1840 who believed that the shift was going to occur in 1890. Joseph Smith had once said, if I live to be at a certain age, I will see the change take place. Well, that if he had lived until that time, he would have been 1890. So a lot of people felt it was coming soon, and they wrote songs like, now let us rejoice, and the spirit of God like a fire is burning. I can sense that spirit in the Buddha community. It's that, now let us rejoice. Like, when you wake up every morning, have a song in your heart for the joy of existence, for the joy of being, and that you're a part of the light. It's a very great, there's an urgency and a beauty with that. To this extent, I'm grateful to be a part of this, the near-death community, and to be here with you, and I'd like to open it up to questions.
Could you tell us a little bit about your near-death experience and in your life at the time of your near-death experience and what changed after?
I usually do not talk about my near-death experience because I feel it's like a fish story, that every time you would repeat it, the fish would get larger. All I can say is this. I had a blood poisoning and I didn't realize I had it. It never hit me until it was on a New Year's morning. And I was in a home of an LDS bishop in Durban, South Africa. And I said, there's something really wrong with my body, you know. My heart is beating very fast. It feels like it's going to burst any minute. I said, could you call an ambulance? And he said, well, this is New Year's Day. You're not going to get an ambulance on New Year's Day in South Africa. But he tried. After an hour went by, my heart was even racing faster. And I thought, well, I'm just going to prepare to die. So I was lying there on the couch. It was like a porch, so to speak, where there was a window. And I was looking out, and I believe I saw the heavens open momentarily, and the light came down. And then the light went back up. And I looked at that light, and immediately my breathing became normal, and the heart. It just became very normal. I found myself in tears because it was such a loving stealing from that light. And when the ambulance did finally come, I said, gee, I don't need you now, I'm fine. But they did take me to the hospital, and they did stabilize the blood. They said that I had severe blood poisoning, that if I hadn't got to the hospital right then, it would have been final. But it was a very loving light, and it was like for the rest of the time that I was in South Africa, I felt like I was walking on cloud nine. It was wonderful. Like, I could see auras of the black people on the trains and the white people, and they were just as beautiful. And I went to school, and I said, you know, there's no reason for discrimination. We're all equal, and these black people here are just as beautiful as you are. And he says, do you know where you're at? This is South Africa. We don't believe in any of this stuff you're talking about. And they base it on the Bible. They quote Bible quotations that showing the superiority of some races and no longer made sense to me. And a lot of things in life no longer made sense. And so the changes don't come immediately. It takes a while. When you start meditating, it's like, feel after a while, well, this is not working. It's just not making any progress. But it's actually, when you do meditate, you can make progress because you are touching the hem of his garment. It's like that woman in the Bible. She went up and she had some issue with her body. Jesus says, I feel like grace has gone from me when she touched the hem of his garment. And that's the way it is in meditation. You actually do have that feeling after meditating for a while. More questions? Yes.
You have expressed beautifully the common elements of the light. Seen by all cultural, the common element is love and compassion. Whether you're an Indian or you're a Tibetan Buddhist or whether you're Christian or any division thereof. So I find in reading Dexter experiences the same commonality. But I also find a wide diversity of specifics. For example, one person like Betty Eady might say there's only a pre-existence and not refer to reincarnation. And another person might see prior lives. One person might see Krishna, and one person might see the glory of Jesus. And somebody like Phyllis Atwater would see Jesus as an ordinary guy. So what do you make of that, and what level is the experience happening on?
Young Thomas Benedict, he is a near-death experiencer from Toco, California. And in his near-death experience, he had a brain tumor that was malignant. He was only given about 3 months to live. And he told his hospice worker, he said, I'm really tired of everything. I'm in this whole thing. When you see that I have died, I want you to wait an hour and a half before you call anybody, because I don't want anybody performing any heroics on me. And so when he did pass away, she followed his advice, and she was waiting for the hour and a half, and after an hour, he revived. And and he said, I am so happy to be alive. So he said, what happened to him is that he had left his body, and he had gone through the tunnel, and he had been met by a being of light. And he said to the being of light, would you stop for a minute? Who are you? And where are we going? So he became very involved in his own near-death experience. And he got something out of this being of light. Namely, that the being of light showed itself as Krishna, Wang Jing, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, Buddha, Lao Tzu. Evidently, these beings of light have that unique ability to transform themselves into what we believe we should be seeing. Like if you are a Buddhist, a devout Buddhist, especially in your yellow robes, you will see Buddha. He will be Lord Buddha for you. And if you are a devout Christian, of course you will see, if you're a Catholic, you'll see the Virgin Mary. The light has the power to transform itself into the Virgin Mary. Or you will see Jesus Christ, and you will see the nails in his or the nail, the prints of the nails in his hands. So the light has more intelligence and more power than what we as mortals think it should have. It's not an exclusive. The light is mostly loving. It's concerned about that you're going to feel at home and you're going to feel like you have arrived where you've always wanted to be. And that can be in the, what do the Buddhists call their heaven? It's the pure land. That you've arrived in the pure land. If you're a Zoroastrian, you go over to the Chinbat Bridge and you'll meet the deities that are there for you. Does that answer your question?
Of course, it could take a lifetime of research, but I like that.
I don't know the name of the book, but I understand that there was a gentleman that had a near-death experience that, rather than experiencing light, experienced darkness. Are you familiar with that story?
Yes, it's Maurice Rollins. I believe that Maurice Rollins or Howard Storm, yes, Howard Storm had a hellish near-death experience. Howard Storm was teaching at the University of Kentucky. He was an art professor, agnostic or an atheist, I'm not sure which, but had an out-of-body experience, was taken by demons, and felt like that they were going to destroy him. So after a while, he thought, well, gee, maybe I'd better say some kind of a prayer out of this. And he couldn't do it any first. The only thing he could think about was the Pledge of Allegiance. He started with the Pledge of Allegiance, and then he thought, oh, Lord Jesus, help me, please. And gradually the light came and dispersed demons in the darkness, and so he had both experience. And a lot of this revolves around fear. Fear will take you into darkness. Any things relating to fear, such as anger or animosity, it'll take you into darkness. Whereas if you have a loving, compassion attitude, you'll go in that direction.
Did you feel, as you went towards light, or the light went towards you, that you were being consumed by the light, or did you feel that your spiritual identity was intact, separate from the light?
Consumed, you mean like being
part of?
Actually, I felt like I was being a part of when I was 8 years old. I had a similar experience. And it's like you're becoming part of something greater, like a greater being. You are part of that, and that's where you really belong. It's like a transpersonal feeling. But there's a wide discrepancy among near-death experiences as to whether you will have your separate identity, your separate soul forever, or whether you will all come back together in the light as one being. I know Hindus would feel that we're all going to become a part of one greater being, Brahmanatman. And that this is a delusion that we're a separate entity right now. We're actually a part of a dream of Brahma, who is this greater reality that's dreaming our existences.
Talking about the light, most of the descriptions I've heard and read are very, very similar. And unless you've experienced it, you have no idea what the love of the light is. And with the people here that have never experienced it, is there any way you can explain to them what that kind of love is? It isn't the kind of love that we have here on earth, and I love you and touch you and what. It's something that is overpowering to you that lasts.
It is overpowering. There are no words that can describe it. And nobody has described it yet unless they have an excellent command of English.
I've been in it without a near-death experience.
Uh-huh.
And had five of my deceased relatives appear to me in the light, and they came one each at a time. And they all gave me the same message, everything will be all right. We love you. And there were no words spoken. It just came to you, and you felt like you can't explain. And they say it's a bright light. It's not. I didn't see it as a bright light. I saw it as a pure, pure, pure light. You didn't have to hide your eyes from. It was something you could look directly into and see. And some people think it's something you go like this. And it isn't. It's something that just surrounds you with love, and you can't explain what that love is. And it stays with you for a long, long time, and it changes your life. You look at everything totally different.
That's exactly the case.
I just want to make a comment, if that's okay.
Yes.
When you said you don't tell your story, your near-death story, because it grows kind of like a fish story.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that I've discovered, and I think a lot of us have discovered, is that it isn't so much like a fish story as it's an unfolding. And as we speak of it, or as we write, or as we focus our attention on it in meditation or whatever, it unfolds more, because we have these finite minds. And the experience that we have is infinite. And there are no words. And so I just wanted to make that comment, if that's okay.
That's perfect. That's
so I think your story isn't the fish story. I think it's wonderful, and every time you share it, I think you give us a gift.
Thank you.
Okay, I've read Embraced by the Light by Betty Eady.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing that I came away learning through her book was that she doesn't believe in reincarnation.
Oh, she doesn't?
No.
No?
She says we only have one life. I've done a lot of reading, and most of the people that I've read say that we do live more than one life.
Yes.
Have you come to any conclusion through your near-death experience, whether or not there is such a thing as reincarnation?
World religions for the University of Laverne, and what the textbook says is that the early Christians taught reincarnation, believed in reincarnation up until the time of a certain pope, and this pope said this is anathema, and if you want to believe in reincarnation, you can be excommunicated, you can be cut off from eternal life. And so it became something that everybody was afraid to touch. A lot of experiencers believe that you need more than one lifetime because this lifetime is just too short. That eternity is too vast and too infinite to bring it down to just one lifetime. There's so many inequalities that happen here. A lot of people don't get the chance to learn anything. It's just a struggle to survive day by day. The unfair that this is all they get.
I've had the opportunity on my radio talk show to interview Edie and Atwater, PM Atwater, I don't know if you're familiar with her, and Dan Brinkley is coming up on the program. And as I read their books, a lot of them have a scary part in it. And I wanted to know more about that, so I asked them about children, because I think that's pure. And over the time when I've interviewed all these, and more people than that, I find that the children, the stories are not convoluted, or they're not tainted by belief systems. When I talked to Dan Brinkley, when I was setting up the program, I asked him that. He said that we have a lot of our belief systems that carry over sometimes into the near-death experience, and we bring them back, whereas the children don't have that so much, and you get a pure experience when they talk about it. And I find a lot of solace in that, in listening to the children more so, because you don't get all the great religious dogma that some people take with them a little bit as they go into these near-death experiences.
Well, most children do say that it's more like a loving grandfatherly presence, or a loving fatherly or motherly presence that they're feeling, the warmth of home, real home.
My friend here and I just recently went to Burma.
Oh,
and
wow.
Well,
you got in and you got out?
Got alive.
Congratulations.
Well, but while we were there, there was an awful lot of talk about reincarnation. Depending on where you were in Burma, we traveled quite a bit throughout the country. Some sects, I guess is a good way to say it, or at least groups in different parts, some believed in 26 lives, some believed in over 100 lives, some believed in maybe a dozen. There was one place we went where the people, when the new king was crowned, they went to him and said, "We don't want to come back again. This life is so hard and so full of sorrow and so difficult." And he says, "Well, okay, then our group You better live your life good this time because you won't have another chance to redo it. You know, according to them, the king could set the stage and deity would recognize that, according to them. The books that I've read by many near-death experience people, you know, they meet their ancestors over there and whatever, and they're not involved in their life.
Right.
No matter how, they also, like this other lady, say that, no, that you have one life.
Right.
There are conditions and opportunities over there if you miss them down here that you can, I don't want to come back again. I feel like those people in the other place, one life in this world is plenty for me. And if there's more than one, then I just say, just take me to hell.
Well, he deserves applause. yet the universe is a very, very big place. There may be some planets out there that you'd want to go to because... I'm kidding.
Well, I can't follow that, that's for sure. I have two questions. I'm going to limit to just one. I have two very, very close friends, one male, one female. Both are in advanced stages of cancer,
yes.
Both terminal. What would you advise me that I could share with them? Either reading materials, sources, experiences, maybe in their difficulty, to give them some solace and hope while they're being racked with this terrible, terrible disease.
There was a suggestion that you want to tell them that they've lived a good life and that they're loved beyond their wildest imagination. The love that awaits from them is beyond their comprehension. And that, what can I do for you to make this more comfortable for you, make it a better transition? You could ask them that. Well, I know it's a very, very difficult thing to go. I was with my father before he passed away, and it was a 2-month ordeal of giving him the medications and getting up at night to take him to the bathroom things and trying to get rest myself, and working with hospice is a very difficult thing. And sometimes he would get angry at me and because I was trying to give him too much, and so you don't want to force anything on them. Like I would read scriptures from the Psalms and you would get irritated with that. So then you just have to back off.
It's the natural intuitive thing to do is to be so pain-centered, although both of these people are really genuinely very spiritual people and do have a vision, but at this late stage, particularly in the one case, is so difficult. And I'm just trying to say, what is it from a different dimension to give some peace, the best in the mind and in the soul, to be reading, like you say, scriptures, and are there other sources that maybe
all kinds of books?
Let them teach you.
Maybe even books on tape, something along those lines.
This, I recommend this book. This is a class. I swear, this is beautiful. I mean,
thank you.
May I say something on this?
Yes.
I'm a hospice chaplain.
Yes.
And I've talked to a lot of people who are suffering in the end stages of their life. And I've learned that there's nothing that, not necessarily, that you can tell somebody and fix them. That's just impossible. What's very valuable is for you to be present, to be there, to listen to their story, to accept their doubts, let them express their fears, empathize with them, be there, love them, have compassion, and care for them. And in most cases, they will find their own solution to their questions. And I have found that especially people who have been raised in a particular religion, any of the many religions, they have very serious doubts from their bishop, from their priest, from their minister. They've been told all their life that, you know, Heavenly Father is going to be there, all is going to be well, and they don't believe it at that point. They have doubts about it, and they're afraid, are they really going to go to heaven? or they weren't perfect, so there's got to be some suffering, some punishment somewhere. They would not express those sentiments to their priest or minister or bishop, but they would tell it to someone who is just there to listen, to be a companion on their journey. And they have to be able to express those fears and to go through them, to go through the pain. And if you can assure them that there is an ultimate being, a love, the Holy One, who is more forgiving, as you said, than anybody can imagine, that there is love for all of us, no matter what we've done, that they can find hope and salvation in that. But you cannot expect to go there and just say a few words, or many words, and hope to fix them. But the friendship that you offer, the compassion, and that's another word of love. Very deep compassion is when you feel the pain of one another, and you feel the pain of the other. And what you said about Rumi and Rami, I've studied both those authors very much, and it's amazing. Rumi lived in the 13th century, and he is just expressing the sentiments of today's hospice chaplains about listening to the story, about being there, about loving and accepting and being compassionate.
My name is Irene Smith. I just returned to Utah in March after being gone a year and a half, caring for my father as he went through the dying process. I was asked to take him home and help him to die because he had about 6 months to live. There really wasn't anywhere to take him, and so I moved to Washington where I had grown up with my family. The irony of it was I had only been there exactly a year earlier to help my mother do the same thing. And I slept at the foot of her bed on a Costco Aero bed mattress, thinking, not knowing how long she'd have, and in 3 weeks she passed. I bring that up because there was a consistent experience that was very comforting to me that segued the two deaths. When my mother, in her early 80s, I was the one that told my family, being the oldest child in the hospital, why she wasn't feeling well, that she had terminal lung cancer, and that she had 6 months to live. However, she died in less than a month. I asked her where she'd like to go, and she said, all I want to do is go home and be with my family. She didn't like needles. She didn't want any IVs. She wanted to go peacefully. And so that's what I honored, and I gave, administered to her the morphine every few hours. And being a person in the health and wellness industry who's pretty much against all of that sort of thing, I just felt, it's okay. This is her choice, you know, this is what she wants. A few days before her death, my father, being the computer guru he was in two rooms away from her, typing up, just to be ready, heaven only knows how long it would be, her funeral program and her eulogy. And just to get placement right, he put in a date of September 25th. The hospice staff came in and were there every day, a couple times a day, and saw that. And they said, you know, just know that we believe that it's not uncommon to have out-of-body experiences when people are going into this light. And to be careful what you say and what you do, because they are closer to you than you know, even in another room. I finally left to have some time on my own for a few hours. And my mother passed while I was gone. And when I came in to see my dad, he was weeping, of course. And it was September 25th, the date on the program. Now, fast forward a year and a half later, my father had come home and been home for a couple of weeks. He had terminal prostate cancer, which he did not die from. He died from his heart stopping from the administration of chemo. My brother and I were in the other room working on his eulogy and his funeral program. My father cried out and he yelled and said, "Where are they? Where are they?" So I went running down to the room. I said, "Dad, it's only Brent and I are here. The rest of the family aren't here, but we're here. What do you need? He said, no, no, no. Where is everybody? And I said, it's just the two of us. No, where is everybody? They're supposed to be here to meet me. And I said, Dad, who are you talking about? Well, I'm dead, and where is everybody? I said, Dad, why do you think you're dead? Because I know I am. I said, well, what do you make of me being here? And he said, well, all I know is that I saw my funeral program and my eulogy, and it said I'm dead in there, and I saw the date.
Yes!
And so I sandwiched those two experiences together, and then, beautiful side note, my dad was hoping that all of the siblings could arrive before his journey was passed. And I was holding his hand. I hesitate to say this, but I hope that it will be received well. His last dinner with us, he came in his wheelchair into the nook to eat, and he said, I need a big eraser. I said, Dad, I'll try to find you the biggest one I can. There should be one in your desk. You're so neat and organized. If you just tell me which drawer it's in, I'll go get it. He said, oh, no, that's not what I need. And I said, what do you mean? I need a big eraser. I wished I had a really big eraser. I said, what for? He said, so I could go back and erase some of the things that I did. I would do things differently. I would treat you differently. My dad had abused me as a child, and in the way that he thought he was supposed to, because he learned that. And he had begged me over the year and a half to forgive him with tears. And a couple days later, I was holding his hand, and he was squeezing my hand. And he said, am I okay, Irene? I said, Dad, yeah, you're fine, you're okay, we're all here. No, that's not what I mean. Thinking, okay, what is it this time? He said, am I okay? And I said, Dad, you're okay. I have your pain meds here. Do you want to drink water? No, that's not what I mean. Irene, am I okay? And I said, why do you think you're not okay? Because I'm up here at the ceiling looking down at me and all of you. Am I crazy? And it was only the following day that I discovered that a 3-day process had enlisted where he was being interviewed, and it didn't matter if it was the middle of the night, it went on for days. And it was draining to watch. He would weep and then he'd smile. And at the end of it, we were all in the room, and he looked forward and he said, oh my delight, do you see him? And we said, oh, Dad, do you see somebody from the other side? Is it your dad or your grandpa or who is it? Oh, no. Don't you see him? And I said, who is it you see? He said, it's Jesus. He's standing right there in front of the door. And so I take a lot of solace in that, and other little things happen, but we recorded our experiences on video camera for our posterity. And it's just been a great teaching tool for me to go through that, those experiences. And I asked my father as I was there in the morning, 5 minutes before he died, I know hospice told me, don't go asking questions. Just make statements. Tell them you love them and you're there and leave. Because they'll try to come back and have to start their journey over on the bridge to the light. And I took a chance and I said, please forgive me, Dad, but I have to ask one last question. Is Mother here? And he smiled and his eyes were wet and he said, yes. I'm sorry, that was so long. But I wanted to maybe give some other people some insight into my own experiences in the last years.
I don't know if this is appropriate or not, but I want to respond to the gentleman over here, if it's okay. I've written a little book about my experience, and you may not know about it, but a lot of people have been telling me that they they purchase this as a condolence card and send it as a condolence card. And a lot of other people have, I shouldn't say a lot, about a dozen people have bought it in multiples because they have given it to their family when they were diagnosed terminally. And so if you'll see me afterwards, I have a few. I know there were people last month that I had to get a new printing done. I have about 40 in my car. So I've gotten a new printing done if anyone wants them. And you can also get them off the website. But I just didn't want you to get out of here without knowing that.
What is your website? It's Death, It's a Journey to Life. And I don't want to take away from anything.
That's the name of your website?
The website is www.journeyandthenumber2life.com.
I just have a quick question. Just wondering if Gary could give us a short explanation of what the book consists of. What's the title?
Oh, this book? The Chicken Soup for the Soul, but right. Mostly exclusive near-death experience.
And you wrote a preface or something, and you must have written something involving, your own, what you shared with us today, perhaps.
Part of it's in here, part of my experiences in here, as well as other experiences, their experiences. It's divided into 52 chapters, so there's a meditation, a short chapter for each day, or each week of the year, which I find, those of you who use the daily word, for example, in Unity, there's a daily word, and I find that if I use the daily word, time just goes by too fast. But if you have a week to, our greatest joy, so what I told you about what the Egyptians said about joy, that did you experience joy and did you give joy? If you have a week to consider that, then go on to another week. And then at the end of the year, you can go back and read the comments you wrote.
I was just wondering, in your life, is there a difference between meditation and prayer, or is it one and the same?
These are also full of prayer. The affirmation is like a prayer. It's something you want for your life. Like I explained, what the Dalai Lama said about the mantra of Tibet, Om Mani Padme Hum, means the six powers of the things you most want in your life that you're asking for, that you're praying for daily, that you're reminding yourself of faith, hope, charity, honesty, chastity, benevolence, virtue, whatever comes to your mind, whatever you feel you need, that's the praying portion. The meditation portion is when you become still. You invite the light to reveal itself. You listen for it. So the prayer is you speaking. The meditation is you listening.
I would like to know if you can explain how this experience has changed your life, and if you consider yourself a religious or spiritual person.
I find that I would consider in my book, I call myself a Christian mystic, which means that mysticism is a term that means that you are trying to develop this relationship with God as if you are one and the same. Mysticism is something that was developed during the time of Prophet Rumi, when he compared himself to a reed that had been plucked from the source. And he longed to get back to the source or feel his roots where he originally came from, which is this divinity. It's See, we've all come from divinity, which is light. There is one power, one love, one power, one love, one presence. And we're part of that. It's like we are ripples on an ocean of light. We come from that light and we're going to return to that light. And so feeling a part of that is what mysticism is all about. When it comes to religion, I like the quotation of Leonard Cohen. He said, forget all your perfect offerings. Because no matter how hard you try to please a deity that you imagine in your mind, you're going to fail. And the guilt that follows that can be intense. And it's that guilt that can bring you down. And especially if you come towards the end of your life, all this guilt comes back to you. You know, what I could have done, what I should have done this better. And there's no need for that. Religion often acts as a hindrance to feeling this connectedness to the light. The light understands what we're going through. This has been a long history of this planet. Look at the number of people who have already been through this. Understands fully. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Okay. Part of it, so part of it is, how do you think it has changed you after your experience, after your death?
How did it change me? I just feel like I've become more open to a wider perspective of, like, the totality. Say, it's difficult to explain. My father was a return missionary from Holland, but he married someone who was in unity, or had a unity consciousness from near Independence, Missouri. It's a complex thing. When I'm at unity, I feel like, well, now this should be the original Zion. This is what Joseph Smith intended, because he said Zion. I mean, Independence, Missouri is where the Zion is going to be reestablished. And so we've got Unity Village there. So, there's a dichotomy. You balance the two sides of your life, the Unity side and the Mormon side. The light can help you do that. That's the great thing about the light, is because it fills you with an understanding. Well, it's all the same, in spite of the fact that they're saying this, they're saying this.
With our mind, we cannot rationalize it. We cannot understand it. Right. Not with our mind.
Right.
It's a separate thing, mind and spirit.
Right.
And a lot of it we accept by faith, but we listen to our heart. Because as a Christian, I believe that I have soul, and that is part of God, spirit in me. And they communicate, and that is the connection between me and God. So if I listen to my heart, meditate, I will know in my heart what is the right thing for me to do. And even if it turns out to be a mistake, you've done the best you could at the time with what you knew. And God loves you, and God accepts you for that. And this is how we learn on this earth, in this life.
Right.
Listen to your heart. Listen to your heart.